everybody.
Recording in progress.
You can all hear okay online? Yeah? Nice to see you all. Thanks for being here, you guys, in person. I missed you all, had a good week with our family. Because of the big blizzard in New York, they didn't leave when they were supposed to leave, so they stayed an extra couple of 3 days. So that was nice. And our son Aaron just left this morning. So thank you to Marianne for her great reflections on chapters 22 and 23 of the Dhammapada, hell, and the elephant. She drew the good ones, and I enjoyed what she had to say and all of her AI research. But I especially enjoyed imagining that I was an elementary school child in her office, playing with toys as she watched over me. And I bet you it was a great relief to some of those kids to get out of that stressful, difficult classroom and into this really safe and wonderful space that I imagine it must have been. So this week, I'm going to go on with the next chapter of the Dhammapada. But before I do that, I just have two more pieces of bad news to report to you. Some of you may know about these things. First is the death of David Chadwick, who was one of the earliest students of Suzuki Roshi, and many of you, I can see, knew him. He was one of the first priests in the first batch of priests that Suzuki Roshi ordained in the United States at Zen Center. David was a tireless keeper of Suzuki Roshi's memory and legacy and archive, and he wrote many wonderful books himself, including most famously his deeply researched and lively biography of Suzuki Roshi, Crooked Cucumber, which everybody should read if you're interested in Suzuki Roshi. It's a brilliant and wonderful book. David spent years and years interviewing everybody who knew Suzuki Roshi and looking up all kinds of information about Suzuki Roshi's early years before he came to America. David was a colorful guy and a wonderful person, and anyone who met him doesn't forget him. He was really something. He had always a kind of impish smile, a kind of faint but unmistakable Texas accent, and a very expansive, informal way of speaking. And his contribution to the Dharma and to our lineage family in particular is really immense, and he will always be remembered. We heard of David's cancer diagnosis not that long ago, and I had some correspondence with him, and I thought, he said, oh, I'm busy, I'm working on my next volume of Tassajara stories, and I've got lots to do, and I'm going around doing lots of stuff, keep working. And I thought he'd be around for a while, so it was a little shocking when we heard that he died. Also, I am sorry to report from our Dharma brother, Anka Rick Spencer. Some of you know Rick, that he has a serious cancer in both lungs. So that doesn't sound good. Rick is one of the pioneers of our Mountain Rain Sangha up in Vancouver. And he ordained up there with me and received Shiho. And he would come to Mata Hare, and he loved Mata Hare so much and loved the Mexican Sangha so much that he learned Spanish. He became totally fluent in Spanish and moved to Mexico, where he's been living for the last decades. And at the moment, he was living in Vallarta for a while, and now he lives in Mexico City, where he is having a good medical care, and Argelia, another one of our priests in the Mexican Sangha, is there taking care of him. And so far, we don't know what the prognosis is, but it's very concerning. And we're chanting for him, and we will continue to chant for him. So, not great news. So tonight, chapter 24, craving. It's a long one. In fact, it's so long that I don't think I'll go any further than just that one chapter tonight. And we'll start with that, and we'll take up Marianne's homework afterward. And it's a long chapter because craving is a really, really important thing in Buddhism, right? It's maybe like the most important thing. It's the pivot point, the fulcrum of our suffering. And since the whole point of the Buddhist path is to overcome suffering, we really need to understand this point about craving, how to identify it, how to overcome it. That's really the whole path. So chapter 24, craving. The craving of a person who lives negligently spreads like a creeping vine. Such a person leaps ever onward, like a monkey seeking fruit in the forest. So we talked earlier about the Four Noble Truths, suffering, cause of suffering, end of suffering, path. And the cause of suffering in Buddhist understanding can be seen in various ways. Sometimes we say it's desire, sometimes attachment, clinging, sometimes ignorance. But the basic point seems to be that there is something very, very deeply ingrained in the human mind that it gets caught up in things and gets spun around by them, hooked in much the same way that an addict gets hooked. And this being hooked is called craving. It gets hold of us and it won't let go. And it can be very, very strong and agonizing, as in the case of someone that we call an addict or someone with an actual addiction. But it can be no less strong but more subtle in most of us. One way or another, we get tossed around by our craving. We become habitually restless. We can't relax or be content. And that restlessness drives us to all sorts of unwise and painful conduct that produces the suffering in our own lives and those around us and ultimately in the world. So to practice Dharma is to confront, understand, and reduce this natural tendency to crave. And mostly this means having the capacity to pay enough attention to our mind, to our life, so that we can see how the suffering arises from craving and let go right there over and over again at the point where suffering begins, to understand how to do that. By contrast, ordinary life, a life where there is no practice, is a life of negligence, which is to say not paying attention to craving and therefore being caught up in it. In this verse, craving is compared to a creeping vine, a twining vine, as Dogen says it, a vine that grows so quickly that it inundates its host plant and eventually chokes it off. Craving is just like that. And also in the verse, it's compared to a restless monkey that never stays still, but leaps from tree to tree, always looking for the next piece of fruit, even whether he's hungry or not, you know, leaping from tree to tree. Sorrow grows like grass after rain for anyone overcome by this miserable craving and clinging to the world. That's verse 335, 336. Sorrow falls away like drops of water from a lotus for anyone who overcomes this miserable craving and clinging to the world. So here we have a different metaphor. Now it's grass this time, but also it's drops dripping from the edge of a lotus leaf. After a rain, the grass springs up really quickly. And no one planted it, right? No one was cultivating the grass, but it just jumps up and it takes over everything. The water on the edge of a lotus just drops effortlessly down, gracefully. And craving is sloughed off just like that in the lives of those who follow the path. And the process is effortless and natural just when by paying attention and making the effort simply to be present with what's actually going on in life. It just works that way. The phrase clinging to the world used in these verses means being caught up in the world, hanging on for dear life, unable simply to live in the world, be in the world with some peace and some satisfaction. This I say to you, verse 337, good fortune to all assembled here. Dig out the root of craving as you would the fragrant root of birana grass. Don't let Mara destroy you again and again as a torrential river breaks a reed. So I guess we understand the speaker in this verse to be the Buddha who's saying to us, you know, good luck in your practice, or maybe saying to us, you are lucky. You are already lucky because you have discovered the path. So you're on your way. And what you have to do is dig up the root of craving. Because if you cut down the grasses and slash away at the vines without pulling out the roots, it really won't do a lot of good. You know, you'll put out a lot of effort, but before you know it, it all comes roaring back, maybe even stronger. No, you have to pull it out by the root. Because the power of craving is really strong. One has to respect it. It's like a torrential river in flood time that sweeps everything away. Birana grass, I guess, is a kind of grass that grows really, really fast and apparently really does have a fragrant root. And this seems like a particularly great metaphor for craving because it's true that the root of craving, the craving, you know, is very unpleasant when it gets hold of you, but the root of the craving is pleasant, fragrant, and nice, right? We want to crave. Before we know it, we're overcome, but we want to crave because it's so nice what we crave. We're attracted to what we crave. But then once the craving happens, we're overcome and things get unpleasant and difficult. So we have to pull it out by the root. And the root is fragrant and pleasant. So maybe when we get down to the root, we think, well, maybe not. Maybe I don't want to pull it out because it's so nice and so fragrant. But there's no other way. And in this sense, Buddhism is literally radical. And the word radical means, you know, by the root. According to Buddhism, as this verse says, and you see it in many, many places in Buddhism, not only in the Dhammapada, it's not enough to make things a little bit better. That won't work. The only way is to completely cut through the root of craving. As the next verse, 338, says, just as a felled tree grows again if the roots are unharmed and strong, so suffering sprouts again and again until the tendency to crave is rooted out. How do you do that? Well, in the next verse, we come back to the image of craving as water. And now, rather than a torrential river as it was in the previous verse, now the craving is 36 strongly flowing streams. 36 streams stands for the 12 pillars of the world, which is what causes there to be a world for us, which is the six senses, including the mind as a sense, and the six sense objects, including thought and objects of consciousness. That's the world, right, as far as we're concerned. So there's 12 of those times three, because there's three kinds of craving. And that makes 36 streams flowing. The three kinds of craving are actually important to think about, because there's a little more to it than you would think at first. The first one, I think we would have think very obvious, craving for pleasant things, nice things, happy things, pleasant sensations, pleasant thoughts, pleasant experiences, tastes, and so on. The other two kinds of craving are less obvious and far more difficult to see and to let go of. These other two are craving for becoming and craving for non-becoming, which are the opposite, but we have these kinds of craving. Craving for becoming means craving for life, for identity, wanting to do more and be more all the time, especially wanting to live more and not to die. And this form of craving, I think, most people would completely affirm. I mean, isn't this what life is all about, right? We want to live more, do more, be more, have lots of kinds of experiences of all kinds. We want to grow, we want to develop, we want to know things, we want to improve. Who doesn't want to do that? Everybody wants to do that. And of course, we can't do that if we're dead, so we don't want to die. We want to keep on doing all this great stuff because it's so great to be alive. So what's the problem with any of that? But from the point of view of the Buddha, to crave becoming is a deep and subtle root of suffering. A fragrant root for sure, but in the end, brings us to a path of anguish. It seems innocent enough, even wholesome, but it's not. The third kind of craving is the opposite. It's the craving for non-becoming. This goes along with the other, it's actually the other side of the coin, where we don't want to live. We find it painful. We are in despair. We find life hideous. Rather than wanting more life, we would like to end life as soon as we can, to get out of this horrible trap that people think is so much fun, but it's not. Life is unbearable, painful. Even the things that seem wonderful and pleasant are even more painful because they're so meaningless and so pointless, so much not joyful. And there's no point in being alive. And that very pointlessness is horrible. And you want it all to go away. You want there to be nothing, nothing, just blank. Nothing and blank can sound a little bit like nirvana, but it's not anything like nirvana, because nirvana is non-craving. It's not craving, non-becoming, it's non-craving. So nirvana is full contentment with what is. Whether what is pleasant or not pleasant, nirvana is full contentment with it, even if what it is a swift path toward death. With nirvana, that's okay, if that's what's happening. With the 36 streams of craving flowing mightily toward anything pleasing, the person of wrong views is carried away on the currents of lustful intent. That's verse 339. To crave in any of these three ways of craving is to hold wrong views. even if you don't know you have wrong views or any views at all. The correct view is to understand that craving is painful and to try to let it go. If you don't know enough to make that effort, you are going to be carried away by the torrent. Verse 340, the streams flow everywhere. The creeper of craving sprouts and remains. Seeing that the creeper has sprouted, use insight to cut it at the root. So craving wouldn't be there if we didn't hold wrong views, even if those views are unconscious. To embrace correct view, we need insight, correct knowledge, which is the opposite of wrong views or ignorance. To crave in any of the three ways of craving, and I actually think that the three ways of craving always go together. I think we're always craving pleasure, becoming, and non-becoming at the same time in varying degrees depending on our circumstances and our personalities. We're all so full of contradictions, you know. Sometimes what we think we're experiencing is the opposite of what is also going on. So it requires that we deeply believe, to crave requires that we deeply believe that there is something to crave, right? That there's something that we really do want to cling to, especially ourselves. We believe that we really do want what we want, and that wanting what we want will give us what we need. We believe that. We cling to ourself and our sense of need and self-protection. But we can see through that. I think practice helps us to see through that and understand that there really isn't anything at all to cling to. And that, as we'll see in a minute when we recall Marianne's homework assignment, we see that there isn't anything other than connection. No things that are connected. Only the connection. And therefore, there is nothing that can be clung to. That's the right view. And that's what we come to understand through the process of our practice. The next verse goes on with more about what happens when we continue with our erroneous views and our craving. 341, when desire flows, pleasure arises. Attached to happiness, seeking enjoyment, people are subject to birth and old age. 342, surrounded by craving, people run around like frightened hares. H-A-R-E-S, hares. Held by fetters and bonds, they suffer repeatedly over a long time. The image of a frightened hare is vivid here. Some of you, if you've been to Samish Sashin, there's a lot of hares living there, and you're walking on the path from the zendo to the dining room, which is a long walk, and you see all these hares running back and forth, you know, bopping around, little bunny rabbits. And they actually do look a little fearful, you know, when they hop. And there's a good reason that they're fearful, because they are excellent prey for the raptors, the eagles up there, and the foxes and the bobcats. And we're just like that too. We're hopping along just like that, frightened, skittishly looking over our shoulders for the predators of shame and blame and humiliation and oppression and sickness and old age and death and disgrace and all the things that we absolutely are frightened of that are just around the corner every minute. Our nervous eyes darting from side to side as we move. Surrounded by craving, people run around like frightened hares seeking dispassion. A monastic should dispel craving. Here we can take the word monastic to mean not just literally monastics, but anyone who wants to break the habit of craving and find peace. Dispassion then means the opposite of craving, being cooled down and able to appreciate what is just as it is, without the extra craving and the grasping that distorts it. Though clear of the underbrush and out of the forest, someone attached to the forest runs right back to it. Come, see that free person run back into bondage. Verse 344. And I think we know this pattern. It's sort of common in the world of addiction. People often break the habit. They manage to stop using whatever it is they're using, but they haven't seen through it deeply enough. So when something happens that throws them off, they relapse. And they were free for a little while, and they end up, because of their unaddressed craving root, going back into bondage, and it's really sad. But it happens to everyone, even those of us who are not called addicts. From a Buddhist point of view, there are only addicts. There's no normal person, you know. There are only addicts. And I remember Bernie Glassman, our old teacher, who used to, you know how they say in a 12-step program, "Hi, my name is so-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic." He used to always begin his Dharma talks by saying, "Hi, my name is Bernie, and I'm addicted to self." Because we all are. We are all addicts, and therefore subject to this craving that's so difficult. This next one is actually three verses together. It's not a strong bond, say the wise, that is made of iron, wood, or grass. A strong bond, say the wise, is infatuation with jewels and ornaments and longing for children and spouse. That bond is weighty, elastic, and hard to loosen. Having cut even this, they go forth free from longing, abandoning sensual pleasures. Those attached to passion are caught in a river of their own making, like a spider caught in its own web. But having cut even this, the wise set forth free from longing, abandoning all suffering. So I thought about this for a while and consulted different translations and commentaries, and this is an interesting and subtle passage about the nature of human clinging that seems to be based on a subtle analogy, extended analogy of a spider's web. And as we've seen many times in Dhammapada, the Buddha often uses natural metaphors because he's speaking a lot of the time to ordinary people, farmers and villagers who are surrounded by, you know, water buffaloes and fields and lotus flowers growing in the mud and all that. And most of the time, the metaphors are fairly straightforward, even though we don't know the details. But sometimes, as in this passage, the metaphors are more subtle than they look at first, and they carry more meaning than is apparent in the beginning. In this case, the Buddha is talking about the quality, the specific quality that causes us to be ensnared in clinging and craving, and specifically how the quality of craving binds us. We could be locked in a jail, an iron cage, or someone could put us in a wooden box, or maybe tie us up with rope made of grass, which is all these things the verse mentions. And these bindings, which are clearly bindings, would seem restrictive and confining, and we wouldn't like them. And we would understand, this is binding. I immediately want to get out of this as soon as possible. But the binding of craving is much more insidious than that. It's stronger than that. Those kinds of bindings are easy to get out of by comparison. The binding of craving is softer and more elastic. And where does it come from? It comes from our own minds, our own seemingly innocent desire for things like shelter and protection and love of family. I think when it talks about jewels and all that, I think it really doesn't mean greediness, because that's easy to overcome, you know, greediness for luxuries or something. This is more like a home and protection and family and all the things that we always want in life normally. Things that don't seem to be bindings at all. But because they don't seem like bindings, they're stronger. They're more flexible and more elastic. A spider web would not seem like a very effective binding. After all, it's, you know, gossamer, delicate. But in its sphere, a spider web is very powerful. It's beautiful, a spider web, and pleasant to look at, but deadly and almost impossible to escape because it's sticky. And that's what the craving mind is like. It's beautiful and flexible and sticky and deadly. It weaves a sticky web that we think is going to capture attractive objects, like the spider who suddenly springs on the captured insect. The mind thinks it is in charge and springs forward to grab what it wants, imagining that it's in charge and it's invulnerable. It thinks it's the boss, but really it's the victim. And honestly, I look sometimes at the world of all these powerful, arrogant people who think that they're in charge of everything. And they don't realize that they are the victims of their own minds, of their own devices, and that in the end, they will lose absolutely everything. Now, spiders know how to negotiate their spider webs because of the way their bodies work, and also because there are parts of the web that are not sticky. And they know how to walk on those parts so that they won't get caught in their own web. And they do their best to maintain their webs. And when there are too many sticky parts, you know, like they proliferate, the sticky parts are getting in the way, they eat those parts so that they won't get caught in their own web. I looked this up with the magical AI. Now that I learned this from Marianne, I can do this myself too, right? So they eat that. They do that. They eat those parts. However, it doesn't work perfectly. And once in a while, a spider will stumble off the unsticky parts, or maybe the spider fails to keep house perfectly, and there's extra sticky parts around, and that happens. They get stuck in their own webs, and they perish. So in this passage, the Buddha is imagining that ordinary people are like spiders who think that they are trapping their prey, but they end up being trapped by their own webs. Like a spider web built by a spider for its own advantage, human beings produce bonds of craving, thinking that these bonds are to their advantage, but they end up being caught in the bonds that they have made themselves. Not true of the wise, who know how to cut these sticky, delicate, but deadly bonds and free themselves. Let go of the past, let go of the future, let go of the present, gone beyond becoming. With the mind released in every way, you do not again undergo birth and death. Verse 348. So now we're getting into how you cut these bonds that hold us to craving. And the first point, as we said before, is just simply to learn how to be present, which means not thinking there's an actually existing past that we can actually regret or resent, not thinking there's an actually existent future that we can get something from or scheme about, and not thinking that there's a present moment in which we are actually here as independent beings in an independently existing world. To be really present is to let go of our concepts and identities and needs and preferences and just see what's actually here. To let it come and go without imposing anything on it. When we can do that, we don't any longer crave becoming. We don't need to go on living in some way, some needy way. We don't need to be more. We don't need to do more. We don't need to know more. This moment of presence is enough, and nothing extra is needed. We don't then get caught up in the currents that drive us on and on into lifetime after lifetime of suffering. Every moment is just complete. And then we're ready for the next one, if there is a next one. For people who have agitated thoughts and intense passion and who are focused on what's pleasant, craving grows more and more. Indeed, they strengthen their bonds. But those who delight in calming their thoughts are always mindful and cultivate a focus on what's unpleasant will bring an end to craving. They will cut Mara's bonds. So in these verses, we see the spider web is Mara's spider web, Mara's bonds, that are cut by the person who practices taking care of their mind. The verses don't directly mention meditation practice, but I think meditation practice is implied because it's thanks to our ongoing practice of meditation, of zazen, that we have the ability to see the mind, to slow the mind, to focus the mind, so that we're not caught up in thinking driven by passion, but we can pay attention and stop craving what's pleasant and running away from what's unpleasant. We see how that happens, and we see how unsuccessful and stupid that is. And instead, we can just appreciate what's pleasant without the clinging. And yes, we do emphasize the unpleasant, the suffering, because it's so natural for us to run away from it. We have to emphasize it intentionally. And we use the suffering to deepen our wisdom. In Pali Canon Buddhism, famously, there are various intentional practices of focusing the mind on highly unpleasant things, like decaying corpses in charnel grounds, or disgusting body parts. And the point of these practices is to take the edge off the illusion that life can be pleasant and wonderful and not unpleasant, to reduce our attachment to the pleasant. Possibly these verses, when they say, you know, cultivate a focus on what's unpleasant, it's possible that these verses are referring to those practices. But I think we can take these verses to mean, as I was saying a moment ago, that we practice paying attention to all kinds of suffering as they arise, and to understand the suffering as necessary. It goes along with our being alive in a body. Necessary and important for the development of our wisdom and compassion. In practicing this way, we avoid the stickiness and the obliviousness that comes from the unconscious tendency to cling to pleasure and run away from anything that's painful. Fearless, free of craving and without blemish, having reached the goal and destroyed the arrows of becoming, one is in one's final body. That's verse 351. One's final body means this body. One is alive in this body with all of its advantages and disadvantages, but there will be no more craving and therefore no more restless birth after birth after birth. Just being here as it is, that's the goal. To pull out the arrow of becoming, of wanting, of craving, and just be willing to be alive with everything. Free of craving and grasping, skilled in words and their usage, knowing the order of the teachings, what precedes and what follows, one is said to be a great person of much wisdom in one's final body. Verse 352. In this verse, I'm struck by the line, skilled in words and their usage, knowing the order of the teachings. The practice is just simply three little things to take care of, body, speech, and mind. And trying to free ourselves from habits of body, speech, and mind that cause suffering and learn how to live with some grace and some peace. Our words, our speech is 33 1/3%, right? Speech, which we project out into the world, and should we share with others, but also we talk to ourselves. So our words are very, very important here. We're talking all the time. People are constantly gabbing and jabbering, and mostly we do not pay attention to what we're saying or realize how significant it is, the words that we utter. Our words are really important, and what we say to each other really, really counts. And it can sometimes seem, maybe you've sort of felt this as we read the Dhammapada, and we hear so much about restraint and carefulness, it can sound as if we're being told that we should speak or live in a kind of controlled and stilted way, that we should be excessively polite and kind at all times, constantly conforming what we're saying or doing to the teachings. I don't think that we need to be unnatural or contrived, but we do need to recognize the seriousness and the power of what we say and what we do and what we think. And I do think we need to take ourselves probably more seriously than we usually do. Think, speak, and act with our full human dignity and with the kindness that I think is natural to every one of us. And when we do that, we will be in accord with the teachings. And I don't think it's necessary for us to rehearse them and give ourselves little watchwords all the time. You know, we can just live our lives, but pay attention and be serious. This is the next verse is a quotation, verse 353. I am all-conquering, all-knowing, stained by nothing, letting go of everything, released through the destruction of craving and having known directly on my own. Whom could I point to as my teacher? That's the Buddha talking, of course. And as we know, in Pali Buddhism, the Buddha is the originator of the teaching, right? The Buddha, he went to different teachers, nobody had anything that could satisfy him, he found out on his own. And while the Pali Canon has somehow a kind of vague background understanding that there are other Buddhas in other systems, in the other world systems, in our particular world system, in our particular era, Shakyamuni Buddha is the first. That's the stance of the Pali Canon. But in Mahayana Buddhism, Buddha is not the first. Buddha inherits Dharma from Kashyapa Buddha and the seven Buddhas before Buddha, which means infinite Buddhas. And especially for Dogen, there could not possibly be a Buddha without a previous Buddha. So there could not ever be a first Buddha. There couldn't be an original Buddha. Sometimes in our dedications, we say, our original teacher, Shakyamuni Buddha, but even when we say that, we understand that there's an infinite, endless round of Buddhas in the past, present, and future, and these Buddhas are non-different from us, and where they live and when they live is right here and now. But here in this verse, Buddha is speaking, and he's saying, I am the Buddha, and I am perfect, unstained, and I am the originator of the teachings. According to Dogen and Mahayana teaching, the reason that the Buddha says this, speaks like this, you know, this way, is that when he originally was awakened and opened up his mouth and just said it straight in the Avatamsaka Sutra and the Lotus Sutra and other texts like that, he couldn't help but notice that people were completely confused by his teachings. The idea of interpenetrating worlds and infinite Buddhas on every moment of time was too hard to understand, so he backed up and did a little bit of remedial teaching. And he spoke about himself in ways like this verse so that people could understand him as an ordinary, if very special, person, and therefore be encouraged to practice. Although the Buddha never actually enters parinirvana, in the early teachings he seems to. And he does it, simulates this so that people would be encouraged by their love for him and their grief over his passing to continue the practice. The gift of Dharma surpasses all gifts. The taste of Dharma surpasses all tastes. The delight in Dharma surpasses all delights. The destruction of craving conquers all suffering. Verse 354. So here comes the unexpected part. To let go of craving for what's pleasant, even though we're scared into thinking, we better do this, otherwise we're toast, still it's essentially a negative task, right? You know, we don't want to do it, it's sort of hard to do, but you know, you better do it for your own good. Take your medicine. Doesn't taste good, but you better take it. But now it turns out that once craving for what's pleasant is gone, the Dharma emerges. And the Dharma is in fact the most delightful thing possible. Way better than all that stuff we thought we were craving. So we're not sacrificing pleasure for some kind of grim truth. In fact, we're giving up our pain, which might look like pleasure, for a truer delight, a delight beyond all other forms of delight. 355, wealth destroys those who lack in wisdom, but not those who seek the beyond. Craving wealth, those lacking wisdom destroy themselves as well as others. So here, wealth might stand for all kinds of pleasures and attachments, seeking what we want without wisdom. What we want ends up destroying us. But when we're wise, we can be wealthy. We can enjoy pleasant things because we won't be caught by them. And we won't be caught by them because we know what we're doing and we know that there's nothing that we possess. And so there's nothing that we could cling to. The next several verses here are about weeds. Weeds are the ruin of fields. Passion is the ruin of people. So offerings to those free of passion bear great fruit. Weeds are the ruin of fields. Ill will is the ruin of people. So offerings to those free of ill will bear great fruit. Weeds are the ruin of fields. Delusion is the ruin of people. So offerings to those free of delusion bear great fruit. Weeds are the ruin of fields. Longing is the ruin of people. So offerings to those free of longing bear great fruit. So these are the concluding verses of the chapter on clinging. And here we go back again to a farm metaphor, weeds, which if you're a farmer, you know, you're tempted to use that Roundup. because it's so hard to control weeds. You know, weeds are so insidious and they just wreck everything. You're trying to grow these nice crops, but the weeds seem to have much more ability to grow than the crops do, and they easily overtake the crops. We're trying to grow the healthy food of Dharma, but the weeds keep taking over, just like the twiny vines at the beginning of the chapter. So the first three verses mention the three poisons, the three bases of craving: greed, which is here rendered as passion, in the sense of desiring, wanting, desperately seeking; hatred, which is here rendered as ill will; and delusion, the misknowledge we all naturally cling to, that we and the world are really here as we imagine that they are. I'm not sure, usually the list is just three, but here there's a fourth one, longing. But I think we can relate to this one. Our constant longing, sometimes conscious, most of the time not conscious, longing that accompanies us our whole life, longing to be otherwise, longing for what could never be. In a way, you know, in a way, all these verses, you know, end with the same line, which seems in a way a little self-serving. Make offerings to ones who have overcome these poisons. Probably Buddhist monks and nuns, right? Make offerings to them, because they're the ones who overcome these four poisons. But maybe the point is not so much that, but that one should recognize here at the end of this long chapter on craving how important it is to overcome these poisons, even though maybe we haven't done it yet, to remember that we should respect this path of overcoming them as the most important thing, and then we should strive to continue that path and never forget about it. Okay, thank you for listening to all that. That's a big chapter, really important chapter, so I wanted to go into it. So just a few practical things. This is our, next week will be our last week on the Dhammapada, and we'll be online and we'll have two chapters to complete our study. And then the week after that, for 3 weeks, and all this is online, you can see it there, we're going to study a fascicle of Dogen called Refrain from Unwholesome Action. And I thought it would be fun to read that because, you know, this whole Dhammapada is about wholesome action and unwholesome action. I thought it'd be fun to see what does Dogen have to say about unwholesome action. So we'll spend 3 weeks on that. And then at the very end of the month, as probably everybody knows by now, on the Saturday, we're going to open our practice period in a different way. Every year, for all these years, more than 20 years, I guess, we've been opening the practice period at the all-day sit. But I was feeling increasingly weird about that, since the all-day sits have now all these people who have no idea what's going on, and we open up the practice period and they say, what? What practice period? We have never heard of it, you know. So we're going to do a standalone event at the church, and the only people who will come to that event will be people who are in the practice period. It'll be online and also in person in the church. So please do come to that on Saturday. We'll open the practice period. We'll enter Tracy Arshuso. And then after that, the seminar will carry on for some months with the text we'll be studying during the practice period, Becoming Yourself by Suzuki Roshi, in parallel with Ashvaghosa's philosophical text, Awakening Faith in the Mahayana. Okay, so now in the time we have left, let's start with Marianne's homework, in case anybody has done that. Marianne said that she didn't have a chance to go through it with you last week, but she did say that she has developed for herself a guided meditation that helps her to cultivate the sense of no separate self in your daily life. So develop her instructions. Develop a simple practice of your own that you can try this week to help you cultivate the sense of no separate self in your daily life. In other words, in terms of this chapter, no wrong view, right view, no separate self. So if anybody did that, we'll start with people in the room, we'll hear from you. We always have low expectations, so don't feel like...